session number 10599, reel 16.
Major English, Reel 16. You referred, Major, earlier with the Germans clearing the villages in the area. What happened to the inhabitants?
They were, to the best of our knowledge, were just put out of their houses, and they had to fend for themselves. I don't think there was any case of being taken to Germany. Possible one or two exceptions who perhaps they knew about who were resistance or something of that sort, but they were just thrown out of their houses and they had to find food and shelter where they could.
Would you go on with what happened next, Major?
Yes, as I said, it was becoming obvious that the Italians were getting cold feet about going through the line that night, and they said, "Oh well, I think." Eventually, they said, "Oh, I think we'd better wait." And so they went off, and I said to the others, "I think we should go through tonight. Now we've got this far. We've walked quite a long way, and we can see this all the country in front of us. I think we should go tonight." And Jack Moore agreed. Scotty White said, "Oh well, I'll abide by the majority." Gillian, I think, was she was quite prepared to go. Douglas, dissent, thought not. He said, "Well, we've agreed we were going to go through on the 23rd or the 24th, Christmas Eve. We thought people would be perhaps a little off guard." And I said, "Well, what's one day in it?" And we discussed this for quite a time, and eventually we agreed we would go, and that night, and that was the night of the 22nd, 23rd of December. We studied the ground closely, and we agreed on our route, which we could see, which we knew, past a German gun position, which we also had seen in the mist before, and down to the village called Guardia Grayley, and through across that road and down to some low ground, and then eventually into a valley of a stream which led more or less north and south. And if we followed that through, we thought we'd come through to the British lines. So we didn't go back to the cave. As I say, it was a little distance from where we'd been able to study the ground. And we got into a shelter position and we ate our last tin of meat, which we'd been keeping for such an emergency. This was, I think, British Red Cross parcel residue, and had some biscuits. And as soon as it was reasonably dark, we set off in fairly open single file, just as wide apart as we could, so we, as long as we kept each other in sight. And we got on quite well, with no bother. We passed this German gun position without any difficulty. And over the road, and everything was going fine. And down the other side, Jack Moore was leading. He tended to go on as soon as he reached a wall or an obstacle, go straight on, and we were getting rather too strung out. And I said to him, "We must make certain that the others are catching up before we go on after crossing these obstacles." And then we got down to a bit of low ground, and came to some very steep screes, really, clay screes, and we couldn't see any way around this, so we agreed that we just had to go up them. And we had the most awful job getting up these steep clay hill, I suppose, and one slipped back as much as you went forward. And after it seemed to me an awful long time, we got to the top, and then we had equal trouble going down the other side, and one could only really go on all fours, and it was sticky mud. Anyway, we got down and had a bit of a rest. I really don't know how long it took us, probably nearly an hour to do really quite a short distance. In daylight, we would have been able, of course, to choose another route. Anyway, we got down and continued on our way. And I was leading then with Jack Moore just behind. And we suddenly saw two people in front of us. And the going was such that one couldn't help making an awful noise as one walked. Anyway, I signaled for the others to get down. We lay down and lay still. And they fortunately obeyed and lay down also and lay still. And we could see, Jack Moore and I could see two, what must have been Germans, and we could see that they had weapons with them. And I thought I could see the German helmet, but that may have been imagination. And they, I think, had seen us. And they were standing and we were lying, looking at each other. I don't know how far apart we'd be, maybe 30 yards, 30, 40 yards perhaps. Anyway, we just lay still there for about half an hour, and eventually they went off. They're making the most awful noise as they walked as well. So then we let them go off for quite a time, and then we thought it was safe to proceed. And once we got going again, Scotty came up to me and said, "Well, what was all that about?" So he hadn't seen the Germans. Well, by this stage, there was a little bit of moon, and it was not a bad night at all. The stars gave us light as well. And we could see on our left a ridge, and we were following down the stream. And I thought, well, I think we've broken the back of this journey. And we just followed down the stream cautiously all the time. And we came across British vehicles and a gun limber, gun ammunition carrier, rather, and a jeep or two. Anyway, we kept going, and then suddenly out of the dark a voice shouted, "Halt! Who goes there?" And this was music, of course, and we hastened to explain we had no knowledge of any password, but we were British officers and we'd had been prisoners of war. And they came up to us and looked at us very closely with the torches and all this. And anyway, the corporal said, "Well, you better come in the guard room." And so we were taken to the guard room and given some rather cold tea. And later on, after an hour or so, we were given breakfast. And that was that. And the sensation, really, of being with one's own countrymen again and being, as it were, a free man was worth all the trouble. And I must say, we all thought really that we got there mainly by divine providence, more than anything else. We were taken back later on to, we discovered, perhaps I should say first, that we had arrived in a battery position of the 1st Airborne Div. And there was a certain inquiry amongst them as to how we'd got through their sentries and how we'd got through the forward defended localities, really, because we arrived up in this battery headquarters. Anyway, we were taken, after breakfast, taken down to brigade headquarters, and I think the first thing that absolutely amazed me, anyway, was the amount of vehicles and equipment compared with the Germans. I mean, the Germans had practically nothing, and what they had was all in the shop window. And there was vehicles, masses of vehicles and equipment and guns and everything. I mean, the British appeared to be so much stronger. But, of course, the Germans had the advantage of excellent defended positions. Anyway, the brigadier came out and asked me a whole lot of questions. And we told him what we could. We pointed out to him on the map where their guns were and as far as we knew where their infantry positions were. And I remember being very embarrassed, really, because I just could not stop scratching with being lousy. I don't know whether he took the point or not. And we were then taken back to Teso, which was a core maintenance area, and there somebody, a signalman, I think a signal officer, said, "Oh well, what can we do for you? We'll give you some British Army clothing." And we said, "Well, that'll be marvellous." We said, "Do you think it was possible for us to have a bath?" And he said, "Oh yes, I think so." And so after a bit, they produced a couple of tubs of good hot water, and that was about the second best thing that happened to us, I think, is that bath was just wonderful. And we managed to de-louse ourselves and put on British clothing, and of course we had battle dress was thick and thick shirts, and we were given vests and long underpants, and you know, the next day or two we were so hot from the comparison with the clothing we'd been wearing, is we really didn't know what to do with ourselves. Anyway, it was nearly Christmas, and we were taken to the town of Termoli, where there was a base area, and we were invited to have Christmas dinner in the officer's mess, and that was very pleasant. And then we went via Bari we went to Bari from Termoli, and there got a ship take us to Algiers. And we sailed on the 2nd of January, 1944.
Was the girl still with you at this time?
The girl had left us at that point. Now, when we were at Atessa having this bath, there was an intelligence officer came up and asked us a few questions. He, I think, was from an organization which had been set up to deal with Allied prisoners of war, and they had expected in the first 3 months of the campaign to have, I don't know, 30 or 40,000 to deal with. And I think by the time we got through, there were only about 3,000 had come. And they were kicking their heels, really. And so he questioned us a bit, quite a few things. And then he said, "Well, what about this girl?" And we told her what we knew about her. And Douglas said, oh, well, she must go on with us. And he said, well, I don't know. We'll just have to look into that a bit more carefully. And she, in fact, left us there. We heard later that she did, in fact, get back to England. And what happened to her after that, I don't know. But I did have hear some mention of her having been in Italy. This was several years after the war.
Were they concerned in some way that she wasn't what she seemed to be?
Well, I think that question had gone through their minds, yes, which I suppose was obvious, really. She had to justify her position, and she hadn't documents on her, as far as I was aware, anyway. So I dare say they kept her in custody for a few months, I don't know. Probably did.
Must have been an enormous release, that actually coming in there.
Yes.
In what way did it show itself, manifest itself between in the group?
Well, I mean, we were all very elated and, you know, and really totally relaxed. I think this was the point, really, that previously we may have thought we were reasonably comfortable. Indeed, we were, I mean, compared with the fortunes of many prisoners of war. But nevertheless, one always had to be alert, and it was a period of uncertainty. You never knew quite know what was going to happen next, you know, even if it was only where your next meal was coming from. So, yes, indeed, it was... It was, looking back, and it was a very marvelous time, really. we crossed the Mediterranean, as I said, on the 2nd of January, and we had the most tremendous storm. And there were sailors from destroyers and corvettes and this sort of thing, and they were being sick. And I was all right, actually. And I kidded myself I was a good sailor. A few months later, on a landing craft going to Normandy, I discovered I wasn't quite as a good sailor as I thought I was. But anyway, but we were told afterwards that this ship was really built only for the Mediterranean. And it was within about 1 degree of roll before it blinking thing capsized, because it just wasn't used to that sort of a storm. Anyway, we arrived at Algiers, and that was all right, and we billeted in quite a good, it was a building, I remember, which had been taken over. And we were there till the 8th of February, and more or less kicking our heels. And we were waiting for a convoy to Liverpool, which we got, as I say, on the 8th of February, and about 8 days later we landed in Liverpool. And
had your medicals at any time?
Yes, we did indeed. We had a quick check in Italy at the Termoli base, and then when we landed in Liverpool, slightly more thorough, I dare say, medical examination took place, which there was no bother about that. They were all pretty fit, and we then went home and were given a month's leave, and which pleased our families, double rations, which we thought was rather nice.
Had your family heard that you were coming home, or was it unexpected when you arrived?
No, it was totally unexpected, really. They had heard that we were prisoners, but we had absolutely no means of letting them know that we got back to the British lines, and they didn't know we were arriving, so it was absolutely unexpected. I rang up from Newcastle Station to speak to them, and they're quite shocked, really. So, as I say, I had a month's leave. Well, one or two things happened on that time. I managed to write out and have typed a diary I had kept of the journey in Italy. So that was with a good lady in my father's air raid precaution. He was a chief warden of the civil defence, and they were pretty quiet at that stage of the war, of course, especially Newcastle or Hewitt. And she did that for us. I also wrote a paper about the birds I'd seen in the Middle East. That was more important. I paid a visit back to the battalion and had a couple of good days with them. And they were at Haverhill in Suffolk then. They had 50th Division had been brought home at the end of the Sicilian campaign. And they were getting ready for Normandy. And the CEO, Bob Lidwell, said, if you can manage to get back, we'll find a hole for you somewhere. And so I went to London to the War Office, because I knew that our ex-CEO, Colonel Beard, who commanded battalion from December or 39 or January 40 through to just before the Gazala campaign, when he'd gone off to command an East African brigade, he was AG1 at the War Office. And I went to see him, and we talked about birds and everything else. And then he said, well, I suppose you want to get back to the 8th. And I said, yes. And he said, oh, well, we'll go and arrange it. And he went downstairs and saw his deputy in AG2 and said, English wants to go back to the 8th and as a company commander. I hadn't said that. And he said, well, I'm afraid they're up to strength with company commanders. And he said, oh, well, we'll fix it. Now, I think perhaps I should explain that I wasn't keen to go back to the 8th from the point of view of glory or anything of this sort. It may perhaps in the future be construed that way. But it's a thing one builds up. All my friends, or those that were left anyway, were in the 8th. I'd been in the 8th before the war. We'd been through some fairly good times during the war, and bad times too, of course, which one tended to forget. But I didn't want them to go off for further battles without me being there, and that's really why I wanted to be where I knew my friends were. So I was very lucky, really, and I got a posting back to 8DLI.
And this was in, where did you say, Suffolk?
Well, yes, they were in Suffolk for several weeks at Haverhill and Steeple Bumpstead and those places. But when I rejoined them...
What date would that be, Major?
That was late in April, that last week in April, that they were near Romsey in Hampshire. And I took over D Company from a chap called Jimmy Califer, who had been in the battalion since late 40, 41, I suppose, had been signal officer. A very good chap indeed. And he felt a bit sore about this, and I felt a bit bad about it too, really. But I think, well, I certainly knew that, and he probably guessed also that with any luck, he would get a company fairly soon after we got over to Normandy, which in fact is what happened.
What job did he in effect take up?
He became second in command of the company, and a very good one too.
What state did you find the battalion in? You'd been away for several months.
Yes. Well, there were obviously a whole lot of new faces, but there were a lot of old faces too, actually, which was very gratifying. And I think one of the main objectives of the training was to knit the new with the old and get a team spirit going. A lot of the reinforcements were pretty well trained. I think initially, anyway, many of the chaps had been in the desert thought they knew it all, and you know, their experience would carry them through. Well, we were to learn that that didn't happen, but they did learn very quickly, but they didn't learn really in time. The army in England, of course, had been training very hard for a European war. We'd been engaged in a different sort of war, and I think with the three divisions that came back from Africa, from the Mediterranean, they all found that it took a bit of time to settle down.
Did they basically learn this lesson in the early days after D-Day?
Yes. In some cases, not early enough. I think with 50 Div, we gave a good account of ourselves from quite early on. But there were occasions, as I'll perhaps relate, when we, you know, we just found things very different.